I forgot to mention, of course, your third book, False Truth and True Rumors. False Facts and True Rumors. I did read the book. I don't judge a book by its cover, so I only read the contents of the book. That's Rabbi Feldman's third book in English, unless there's a fourth book I'm not aware of. Really, that's you know some of those issues that he addressed now. Really, it's a wonderful book on Lashon Hara in the modern age and how we deal with all these issues. So we'll call him back to speak on issues of American war, on terrorism, issues relating to war and ethics.
First of all, when we talk about ethics in general, it's worth just pointing out it's going to have particular relevance to issues of war and conflict, are the questions of how are ethical decisions made in any area. There are a number of different philosophical perspectives, just to oversimplify them. So we know that ethical questions are often viewed through a framework that is either what's known as consequentialist or formalist, or other ways of saying it as well. Do we look at the impact of whatever we decide to do? Do we assume that we are trying to do good? And that's a valid starting point, but we look at the result, and as long as we bring about a positive result, however we measure that, so then we are acting legitimately, as long as we act in the greater interest? Or do we assume that, no, we have to have a system of rules, that we have to have a system of principles, and those principles we stick to, and it's not our role, not our job, to evaluate consequences, but rather to stick to these rules, which is known as formalism. There are other ways of saying it as well. And I think one thing that we see is that we don't take an absolute stance from either perspective. And I think while there are philosophers who are purely consequentialist and purely formalist, I think most of us in this room would not fall absolutely in one camp or another. I think that we'll find that there are areas that we are consequentialist. So for example, a pure formalist would say that lying, for example, is always wrong. It's a moral principle. And therefore, they would never lie, even to save a life.
Can see the play thing.
So is that an attitude
so
that the average person in this room would share? Soon, probably not. I think most of us would probably lie to save a life. If that was a straightforward question, there wasn't anything else to figure out, that if I lie, I will stop somebody from hurting somebody else, that they would assume that's legitimate. And that's an attitude which we find the halacha backs up. The Talmud tells us that it's permissible to lie, not just for life-saving purposes, that we have a much broader license, but even just to preserve harmony, even just to preserve shalom. The Talmud tells us that it's permissible, and in fact goes on to say more than that, that it's actually a mitzvah. It's actually an obligation to lie, or I should maybe say to fudge the truth, because Gemara uses softer language, says the shanos, maybe that means to deviate from the 100% clear truth, even just for the sake of harmony. And obligation, or it's pointed out that even God himself does this, because the Torah tells us that God kind of fudged the report back to Avram when Sarah overhears that she's going to have a child, and she says it's not so likely, and look how old her husband is. And when the report, one pasuk later, comes back to Avram that Sarah is hesitant, it fudges the fact that she identified her husband as old. And the Talmud says, you see, even God himself does this. So there is an interesting discussion in the commentaries as to why that is. If we normally say, Dvar Sheker Tircha, we're not allowed to lie, we're supposed to stay very far away from falsehood. So how come here the Talmud is telling us there are times when it's okay? And you find different perspectives. There are some who say that the definition of sheker is actually defined by its intent, that it's a mitzvah ben adam l'chavero, not to hurt people through falsehood, and if you're doing something constructive, it's simply not sheker. And there are those who say, no, it's going to be falsehood and sheker no matter what, it's just there is an imperative of shalom, and we have to weigh up our different values and decide what's going to win. So we're willing, apparently, to take consequentialist thinking in some areas. So when it comes to a question of an issue like this, of lying to save someone's life for sure, a much more extreme circumstance than what the Talmud says, so we find that that's certainly backed up by Jewish law, and I think it's probably backed up by everyone in this room. I think that's a fair guess to say that everyone in this room would lie in order to save someone's life. So does that make us consequentialists? Does that make us people who decide based on the consequences, as long as it's helpful, we'll do it, and if not, not? So it's not so clear that that's true, because there are areas where we tend to a formalist view as well. And first and foremost, or most relevant to this, is we find when it comes to life and death, when it comes to Ritzicha, so there we take what seems like a formalist attitude. It seems like we have more of an absolute approach, and the Talmud tells us in Sefer Sanhedrin and Daf Ayin Daled that there is a principle of Yehoreg Val Yavor, that if somebody says, kill that innocent person, or I will kill you, you're not allowed to do it. You're not allowed to weigh up the consequences of your benefit and say that, okay, this is something I'm going to do. Essentially, it's absolute, assuming that the other party is innocent. If the other party is not innocent, if the other party is trying to kill you, so then that's called a rodef, and then you are permitted to kill that person, but even that is limited, because the assumption is only while they are going after you, and only to the extent necessary that you can stop them. If you're able to stop them with non-lethal force, the Talmud says you have to use non-lethal force, so it's a limited permission only for the aggressor himself. But if that same person says, listen, I'm going to kill you unless you kill the third party, unless you kill this innocent person, you're not permitted to do that. That seems to give us a formalist attitude here, that that is a principle of an absolute ruling. And the Talmud has an interesting way of phrasing it, which you have to try to figure out exactly what that means. The Talmud says, why is it that you're not allowed to kill that third party to save your life? So the answer is, my chazis, how do you see it? How do you have the prophecy? How do you know? How do you know that your blood is redder than his blood? So what does that answer mean? Does that answer mean that really there is a consequentialist logic here, that yes, if you could somehow establish that you're more valuable than that person, you'd be able to do it. But we can't do such equations, we have no way of knowing that, and therefore, we're stuck. Is that what the Talmud is saying? Is that what that means? So, you don't think so.
Are you asking a question?
Yeah, I'm asking.
I would say, it seems, I don't know, I feel like this, you're asking a question, I feel like it's posh, that none of us has such an insight into the consequence of anything.
Okay.
I left and dropped this today, so, you know, so what's going to happen in 5 minutes? I don't know, I mean, it could be the phone's broken. But what other things, all the ramifications, there's so minimal insight into anything. So
maybe that's the answer here. Right, so why is it that if a minute ago, when it comes to lying, we were willing to take a consequentialist approach, so how come here we're not willing? And it goes even further, because the Yerushalmi discusses a case, which is quoted in many later svarim, that let's say there is a group of people, and a bunch of marauders come and say, we're going to kill all of you, unless you turn over one. So if you turn over one, we'll spare the rest of you. So there, the math is pretty clear, because this person is threatened in the first group. So it's almost impossible to say that there isn't a greater benefit to turning over this one person to save the rest. And yet, my focus in the Gemara over there, Rish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan, under what circumstances, if any, you're allowed to turn over someone. They both agree you can't turn over just any one person at random. It may help if they identify someone specific, and that's also only one opinion. The other opinion is only if that person is somehow worthy of death, is somehow chayav nisa. Hi.
I've always wondered on that Gemara. Mm-hmm. Could you argue that that's a din in Kiddush Hashem? In other words, it's separate from on a boat, let's say, you know, to mm-hmm. throw somebody overboard, like, and you could save everybody, then you would do that as opposed to letting everybody sink.
I'm not sure if you would do that.
I'm not sure, right? That's my question. Perhaps this halakha of not handing somebody over to non-Jews is not so much halakha whose blood, it's rather, it's not done under the normal circumstances, because to hand over someone to a non-Jew to kill is a mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem, which is a totally separate mitzvah.
I'm not sure.
I raised that issue.
Yeah, I'm not sure. We'll see. We'll get to something similar to the boat situation. So we'll see. Hi.
Just one back. You were asking about if you could prove that your blood is redder.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you see that from the Lashon of the Gemara where it says it's Svarah, in other words, common sense, that phrasing means it's not about quantitative redness of blood.
It's inherently impossible.
It's inherent.
Yeah, I think it's an open question what exactly that means, because I'm not sure how to interpret it. On the one hand, it may open the door to say if there was somehow a way to calculate it that would make a difference. But I think sources like this indicate that, no, even when there's clear math here, and it's not just a question. It's one thing, we'll talk about this a little bit more, if it's a 5 versus 1. But here, even though it's 5 versus 1, you can say, who knows, this 1 might be worth another 5. But when it's 1 from within the 5, so then that should for sure be a clear quote, because that person is going to be included anyway. And yet, it's still not permitted to do. And the Rambam paskins that way. The Rambam paskins the more machmir version, that only if the person himself is actually chayav misa can you turn him over. Otherwise, you can't, even though, again, he's going to be included in the original threatened group. So that forces us to say that it's essentially a formalist principle, that this is something we simply are not allowed to take on our own. And it doesn't matter how compelling the logic may be, how much we think we can add up the parts to make sense, we're still not allowed to do the Kesef Mishnah. The author of the Shulchan Aruch commenting over there, he says that the phrase "Maichazis" that appears in the Gemara we see is not really the real reason, because sometimes you could do the math and it wouldn't come out that way. It's apparently had a tradition. The rabbis had a tradition. This is essentially a formalist principle. Now, it's also interesting to wonder, why do we have formalist principles? And I think it relates to what you're saying, and just to kind of illustrate that a little bit, I'll take a question in a second, but I think it's a little bit illustrated through our two examples, that why do you have a formalist attitude towards anything? So there could be a number of reasons, but probably, maybe the most likely reason, is that we don't want to live in a society where people can make these decisions on their own, and the consequences that will emerge from that. If we had to share a world where everyone can decide on their own when it's justified to kill the people around them. So this becomes a large part of the issue that we have with terrorism, that essentially people decide that they have whatever goals that they want, and that therefore they're allowed to do anything in the pursuit of those goals. And we understand the chaos that that inflicts upon humanity. And therefore, when the stakes are high enough, we're not comfortable with a attitude that lets the individual decide when the consequences justify it. And it seems like either one could be a absolutist in formalism, like Kant, for example, like there are those who did take the view, I don't think anyone in this room would take this view, but there are those who would take the philosophical perspective that I can't lie even to save someone's life. And why would they take that attitude? So presumably because the attitude is, as extreme as it may seem to us, and it is extreme from a halachic perspective, but as extreme as it may seem, the assumption is that, listen, from a perspective of morality, we have to have rules all of us follow. And the moment we start to decide, well, I don't have to follow this rule because it's for the greater good, then all of society falls apart. There's no morality anymore. So most of us don't subscribe to that all the time in terms of the question of, say, lying to save someone's life. But as the stakes get higher, so we're more likely to subscribe to that view. When we're talking about life and death issues, we don't want to live in a world where everyone decides on their own when the consequences are going to justify it. And presumably, that's one of the ways in which we come to a formalist attitude. We'll say a little more about that, but I think that's a little bit part of what gets to it. So when it comes to Ritzicha, so we have an attitude that it's an absolute, and we only permit it when the person who is being targeted is the aggressor, is the Rodef, and even then only when it will directly address their pursuit. But beyond that, to kill a third party, to kill an innocent person, that we don't permit. So then the question becomes, so how does war take place? And how do countries that are bound to a moral code, such as Israel and America, and trying to work on Canada, and trying to work off an ethical system, so what do we do to engage in warfare, knowing that innocent people are going to be involved? So the opening premise has to be, to a certain extent, that war is different. Now, how is war different? That's something that we have to try to figure out. We find this in the Torah, perhaps the earliest incidence of war in the Torah is with Avraham Avinu, and the four kings and the five kings. And we find in Chazal, and perhaps implicit in the Psukim, that there was an uneasiness that Avram had about what he was engaged in, that he was there to save the life of his nephew Lot, so he participated in this war, but presumably there were others who ended up being killed in the course of this experience. So there are indications, Rashi indicates, that Avram was uneasy about what he did, that he understood, okay, so to save someone's life, to rescue, to redeem the hostage of Lot, that was legitimate. But anything beyond that, any other party who got killed in that process, he wasn't sure. He wasn't sure whether he would be held accountable for that. Rashi suggests that. And there's a contemporary sefer called the Chavetz HaSharim, it's a popular sefer of the halakhic topics of Chumash. So he notes that Avram wasn't sure, or he said that he didn't want to take the offerings that the king offered to him. Said, okay, here you get to take from the spoils of war, and Avram said, I'm not interested. And he suggests that maybe that was a part of the issue, that when you're dealing with war, okay, so there is such a concept of spoils of war, of one nation conquering the other, and of non-aggressor parties also being casualties. But maybe this was a simple rescue, maybe a straightforward rescue mission. It wasn't the halacha of war, in which case he really had to only be limited to dealing with the pursuers. And there was no concept of spoils of war. That wasn't something that he was entitled to. So this is a hesitation that we find already at this earliest instance of interpopulation conflict. What exactly are the rules? And yet we find certainly later on that we have instances of the Jewish people going to war with others. And clearly there's something that's justifying it. We don't know yet exactly what. Rav Asher Weiss suggests, it's printed in the Shiurim and Parshas Shoftim, that we'll read in a few weeks, that that's part of what Tanakh does for us, that we don't necessarily have explicit psukim telling us what exactly the rules are, but we have the model of Jewish history where we find war being conducted, and a part of the value of Tanakh is to give us the models of our history and to convey that this is the rule of the system. What's probably also relevant, one can raise the question, so there is a discussion in the Sefer Machas Chinuch where he notes that normally we have an exemption of pikuach nefesh from mitzvos in general. So if something is going to be too dangerous, so we're exempt from it normally. But when it comes to mulchama, so mulchama, the mitzvah, we have occasions where there is a imperative of warfare, and yet that does not exempt us just because of pikuach nefesh. It's clearly a dangerous endeavor. We know that not everyone is going to survive. And if the same reality were true in terms of Shmir HaShabbos or kosher food, we would be exempt. We would normally say pikuach nefesh exempts us. Yet, when it comes to mulchama, it's clearly not going to apply. So what does that mean? So does that mean that pikuach nefesh is simply not relevant to warfare? So you have to assume it's not the case. It's not completely irrelevant. But we're starting from a different relevant, that the general, when he makes decisions going into war, is going to try to figure out how to minimize the losses. He's certainly going to be driven by a directive of pikuach nefesh, but we don't have this automatic exemption of danger. And the assumption seems to be that one of the reasons is that we are shifting our perspective from the individual perspective to the national perspective. That on a national level, so we're now looking at the well-being of the entity as a whole, and therefore we look at it from a different angle. And the pikuach nefesh of the nation becomes the perspective rather than that of individuals. As Rav Shechter points out, the Sefer, that would be true even without considering any individuals. Let's say there was an army that was going to come here and say they want to take over Syracuse, and they're not going to hurt anybody, but they are going to make Syracuse a part of their country. So that would also be a legitimate justification for war, because that also has to do with the well-being of the nation. And to protect the nation, apparently we see that there is such a notion of communal entity rather than just individual entity, and that also justifies engaging in warfare. The Maharal of Prague had a similar approach, which gets to the question of interpretation of Psukim that we find in Parshas Vayishlach. So there was the response that Shimon and Levi had to the attack on Dina, that they went and they killed the entire city of Shechem, and there is a question what justified that. So work backward for a moment, and Maharal understood that in the context of national entities, that essentially they perceived that this was the entity of Shechem on a national level, now starting up with the Jewish people, even before there was actually an entity of the Jewish people, and therefore they were justified in responding on a national level. Now that works off the assumption that they were justified. There is a major counter indication that we find in the Chumash, that we find that Yaakov was very upset about what happened, and he brings it up later. So that itself is subject to discussion. And before the Maharal, we have the Rambam and the Ramban, that the Rambam maintains in Mishneh Torah that the reason Shimon and Levi did what they did is because there is a mitzvah of din, that among the mitzvahs that govern the whole world, we have seven Noahide principles, six of them are prohibitions, and one is a positive mitzvah. What's the one positive mitzvah? Justice, din. So there is a debate how to understand what that means. The Rambam understands that it means that we have to protect and enforce the other six concepts. So if anyone in the world violates one of the six prohibitions, so then the general world community has an obligation to enforce that. And that's the mitzvah of din. So here he understands that Shechem, the individual, committed a crime against Dina, and therefore Shechem, the place, the community, was obligated to police that, to engage in the mitzvah of din. And because they failed to do that, so therefore that was why Shimon and Levi took action against them, because they all became guilty for falling short of the mitzvah of din. And the Ramban disagrees with this. The Ramban does not understand it that way. He also takes note of the fact that Yaakov seems to criticize what they did, that they did not do the right thing. So you have to assume that that was not justified. And he understands din in a completely different way. He has a very innovative understanding of din. The Ramban assumes that the code of Choshen Mishpat, the civil law that we have for Jews, is not only for Jews, but all of the monetary rules that we have, all of the extensive codification in Choshen Mishpat, all applies to the whole world, which is a fascinating idea. It's not at all intuitive or obvious, and there's a lot to say about this. There's a fascinating tshuva of Nassim Gishtetner, who was a great posek in Bnei Brak, passed away several years ago. So he had a discussion, probably written in the 1960s or so, of a woman who was a Holocaust survivor. And she was receiving reparations from the German government because of her experiences. And there was a conflict between her and her husband, that her husband claimed that he had right to that money as marital property. So this question came to Gishtetner, and he said, we have to figure figure out what exactly is the status of these reparations. How exactly do we look at this money that the German government was paying her? So he said, on the surface, it seems like this is what we call the Dmei Chavalo. The Torah says that if somebody wounds someone else, so there are obligations, there are monetary obligations that come from that. So we have to figure out, is this considered to be Dmei Chavalo? Is this in that category? Because that's personal property for the woman. The husband doesn't have any rights to such money. So he says, well, if the Ramban is correct, so then all of the laws of Choshen Mishpat, all of the civil regulations, apply to the whole world. So in that case, Germans are also obligated in Dinei Chavala, so that's how we look at this money. And it should be hers personally. It's not for the husband to have any say. So then he discusses, but one could argue that, so the Nazis have an obligation to pay this Dmei Chavala. But this government of Germany, decades later, it's not the Nazis, it's different people, so why are they obligated to pay this? Maybe it's not considered to be Dmei Chavala. So to that he says, now you look at the Rambam. But the Rambam says the mitzvah din requires the society to enforce all the other principles, and therefore there is an obligation on the later German government to uphold this as well, and therefore that's how we concluded that this was her personal property under the category of Dmei Chavala because of this principle of din. Now that becomes very relevant because, let's say, if we consider the question of America's war on terrorism, as the title indicated, so if you recall back right after 9/11, so President Bush took the perspective that he was launching a war on terror, and he said, if you harbor a terrorist, you're a terrorist, which essentially evokes the language of the Rambam here, that not only are the terrorists guilty of their assault on humanity, but a society that provides a haven, provides a harbor for terrorism is also a legitimate target. So that is possibly a category that's relevant to understanding such a conflict, to understanding such a war. But that has parameters also, and it's relevant to a different topic. There's a broader discussion one could have about the question of the appropriateness of the death penalty. Let's say you've been outside of a halachic context, say in America or in Canada, I don't know what the laws are in Canada, but let's say in America, we've debated the death penalty for hundreds of years before there was
a... in Canada.
So in America, it's been an ongoing debate.
Depending on the state in America.
So for 400 years, before America was a country, there was one of the colonies, this has been a debate, and it's an ongoing debate. And there's a lot of back and forth about whether it's morally justified or not, whether it's effective or not, et cetera. So part of the discussion comes up that the Talmud talks about this mitzvah of din, of secular society enforcing its rules, and the Talmud talks about a punishment of isur, of execution, for one who is in violation of the Noahide Code. So what does that say about the death penalty? So does that tell us that there really is an obligation to enforce death penalty all the time? So one could swing from different views on this. On the one hand, say that the death penalty, we know from reading the Talmud, that it was very sparingly applied. And in ancient Israel, Talmud tells us it was very rare that they would impose death penalty. So maybe one would argue that that's the attitude. If you could influence the American government, you should say, listen, as an Orthodox Jew, I'm against the death penalty because the Talmud tells us we're very hesitant to utilize it. Or should we say, no, but from the perspective of the laws of Bnei Noach, it's something which Talmud says should be utilized. Maybe it should be utilized all the time. So how exactly do you approach that question? So there was a fascinating approach. Remember, I'm going to date myself now a little bit. Many years ago, it was in a store, and there was an issue of New York Magazine. And the cover of New York Magazine had a headline, cover story, The 100 Smartest New Yorkers. So, curious to find out who they are, I opened this up. I was proud to see that on the list there were two people who were associated with Yeshiva University. So, one of the two was Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. So, just two problems with it. One is he wasn't a New Yorker, he used to commute from Chicago. Chicago, okay, fine, we'll take it. And two, the picture that they had in the article was actually a picture of his brother, Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. Other than that, we're proud to see him in the 100 Smartest New Yorkers. So in this article, it was a magazine, it's not a book, so they don't have room to prove extensively how they know these are the 100 smartest people. So they only have room for one had just been elected for the first time.
Not so long ago, you're a young guy.
All right, this is going back five terms almost, right? So the elder Cuomo had just been defeated, and Pataki ran on a pro-death penalty platform. And so that was one of the reasons he got elected. He didn't have certain long terms. But so when he was elected, so there's this quote there from Ryan Soloveitchik, who said that Pataki should be very careful about the death penalty. And the Talmud says that a Sanhedrin that executed once every 70 years a bloody Sanhedrin, New York should be careful it shouldn't be a bloody state. So it's interesting because one could argue it's not really relevant. It's a different system. A Sanhedrin is dealing with its rules, and the rules of New York State presumably should follow the rules of Din in the midst of Ben Noach. It's a different story. Why is Rav Aaron quoting what seemed to be a completely different context to Governor Pataki? So in order to answer that question, it's what we call the Shitasa. You can see that it's consistent with Rav Aaron Soloveitchik's opinion in a better magazine. In YU, we have a journal called Basic Stocks, the Major's Journal. So Rav Aaron wrote an article in that journal where he explained his attitude towards the mitzvah of Din. And he said that there's a fundamental difference between the mitzvah of Din as it applies to the world community, to the Noach, and as we find in the Sanhedrin and the like, where there are themes of punishment, and themes of redemption, and themes of Bubiar Tarab Kirbecha, etc., when it comes to the mitzvah of Din in the whole world, so there is a perspective of simply saving the world from harm. Now, like the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, that we should always pray on behalf of the government, the Mali Moro, we should say, below, that if it weren't for the fear of the government, people would swallow each other alive. So we should always look out for the well-being of the government. So one of the major functions of such an entity is to protect society. So Rav Aaron understood that the idea of the mitzvah of Din is to keep society functional, and there is discretion to the dayan, there is discretion to the secular judge to do what's necessary in order to protect society. So that discretion could include the death penalty, if necessary. That's what the Talmud is actually talking about, as he understood it, the upper level of discretion. But if it's not necessary, then it's not necessary. So we have to figure out, and that's why he's invoking the context, a seemingly different setting of the Sanhedrin, saying, look, the rabbis, the Talmud felt you have to be very, very careful and very, very cautious in how you apply this. So too, we should take a lesson from them for New York State. That should be our attitude as well. And it's consistent. Moshe Feinstein had a letter which was written to another New York State governor earlier to Hugh Carey. It's printed in his responsa, where he didn't say the exact same thing, but essentially the same idea, that he didn't say, well, we're obligated to use the death penalty all the time, but he understood it as something that was a present in Jewish tradition, but was meant to be taken with a lot of discretion, presumably it's parallel to what Rav Aaron was saying, that the mitzvah Din requires us to keep the world safe and functional, however, to whatever degree that's necessary. So if we plug that back in, as President Bush said, so here we have terrorism across the world, which is the ultimate attack on Din, is the ultimate anarchy and hefkerus. It is the complete abandonment of a formalist system. So there certainly is a strong imperative to impose Din on that context. But again, how you assess exactly how that plays out, so that's going to be viewed within this prism of what's necessary, similar to the view of Rodef. So essentially, that gives us two frameworks to look at what's going on. Either we use the framework of Rodef, or while Rodef normally wouldn't include innocent parties, perhaps when it's viewed through the perspective of a national identity rather than individual identity, that shifts. Or perhaps we're coming from the lens of Din, which also justifies such pursuit, but again, requires us to very carefully analyze how exactly it's necessary and to what degree. And it's also perhaps very relevant to consider. So when we talk about the idea that when it comes to murder, we're consequentialists last and probably formalists first, and we take a more formalist attitude towards murder. So you're probably familiar, it's gotten more attention in recent years, with the trolley problem. It's a famous philosophical question, which really is old, but the past few decades has gotten more attention with this particular name, that there are many different versions of it. But the idea of the trolley problem is, let's say you have a trolley car that's going down a path, and it's going to hit five people. There are five people who are in the path of the car. And you have the ability to divert it off its course. You can control it and flip a switch. And the trolley will be moved to a different track, and those five people will be saved. But there is one innocent person on the other track. So is it legitimate to do this when you're going to cause the death of one person who was not previously threatened? It's different from the case when you're Shalmi Trumas. Right? That person was not threatened, but you're going to save the life of five people. So is that a justified action? So there's many books that have been written about this, particularly recently. And if one was a pure consequentialist, you'd say, well, what's the hard question here? So it's five against one, so you'll save five at the cost of one. It's clearly indicated. So why is this a hard problem? Why is this something that does give us a lot of work out to try to figure out what the answer is? Because the assumption is that this borders on murder. We're not sure, but the concern is that maybe flipping this switch and making this train go and hit an innocent person who didn't do anything wrong and who wasn't part of the threatened group, that maybe that is an act of murder. And murder, we take a formalist attitude. We decide that we're not allowed to engage in calculations and try to come up with a formula for when it's justified, it's never justified. So that's really what seems to lie at the challenge of this issue. That is that something that's considered murder? Would flipping the switch to divert it to another course, would it be an act of murder or not? That seems to be the issue, and that's why there are various forms of this question. There's a lot written about this in many different ways the question has been asked that raise the stakes a little bit, and you see that that's essentially what the issue is. So for example, there's another version of the question that, let's say there's a large individual standing next to the train tracks, and you could take that person and throw them in front of the train. And that will stop the train, it'll save the five people at the expense of this person who you're going to throw in front of the train. So that ups the stakes a little bit, because then it really feels like you are actively killing someone to save these other people. That's more to be a daim, that's done as a more direct action. So if you were okay with the first case, are you still okay with the second case? If you thought you can divert the train, does that still mean you can actually take a person physically, throw them in front of the train? So that becomes a harder question. So again, what's at the heart of this issue is, when are you actually committing murder in order to save these people? And even if the math will still be the same, when does our formalist attitude towards murder say, sorry, that much we can't do, we have to let God work this out, this is not something that we can get involved in. So this is something philosophers have struggled with. And the truth is, it's dealt with in the earlier generations as well, including the Chazon Ish. And the Chazon Ish talks about a similar case. Avraham Yitzchak Grelitz, who was one of the great posthum of the previous century. So he has a discussion in the Sefer and Sanhedrin about a missile that's going to hit a populated area, and you can divert the missile. But if you divert the missile, then it's going to go to a less populated area. So it'll save more lives, but at the expense of fewer lives. So is it legitimate to do that? Which comes up all the time, especially now we have the Patriot missiles, which knock the bombs off course. So what if you have to look at that question, that you will knock it away from a more populated area, and it'll end up going to a less populated area that wasn't threatened otherwise. So now you're going to essentially sacrifice a few people to save a larger population. Is that legitimate? So Chazon Ish suggests, not 100% confidently, but suggests that that is permissible. Why is that permissible? Because he works off the assumption that what you're doing is a maisa hatzalva. That's considered to be an act of rescue, even though it's going to have the consequence that other people are going to die. Rav Asher Weiss, I heard him say once orally that this statement of the Chazon Ish reflects the fact that the Chazon Ish was on a different level, that even though he lived 100 years ago, but he thought like a Rishon, he was a throwback to the medieval era. But as far as Rav Asher Weiss points out, he's still not sure what the basis is for this. Where does this come from? I think this is a very innovative idea to say that this should be permitted because it is a you, and he wasn't sure that that was justified. So the truth is, I think maybe we could suggest that we could explain the Chazanish's position based on what we've been saying so far. That when it comes to a prohibition like murder, so murder actually affects us on two levels. It is both a consequentialist issue and a formalist issue. That it's a consequentialist issue or that it creates great loss to the world, and it's a formalist issue because we are simply not allowed to do that. It's an absolute. We can't do an act of murder no matter what. So here, perhaps what the Chazanish is suggesting is we're addressing both levels. That from the consequentialist aspect, so we can justify it, we can say that more people will be saved at the concern, at the loss of the fewer number that will be taken under the circumstance. So from a consequentialist perspective, we can explain it. From a formalist perspective, perhaps we can also explain it, because the formalist perspective tells us that, listen, even if it works out as a consequence, still murder is off limits. So it's okay, so is this an act of murder? Maybe if primarily what you're doing is an act of rescue, which has a negative consequence, but the negative consequence is less than the alternative, so maybe you've addressed both halves of the equation, looked at it both consequentially and formalistically, and maybe that's why he's saying that if the action you're doing is an act of rescue, perhaps that can be justified. Now, he's still tentative about it. After all that, he's still not sure that it's true. There's a contemporary sefer came out a year or two ago called Uri V'Ishi on Chumash. So in his essays on Parshas Vayishlach, he suggests that maybe the Chazon Ish wasn't sure how to define what is called an act of rescue and what's not called an act of rescue. And that maybe the definition is that we look at the immediate action that you're doing. If you're acting to hurt someone, that's called an aggressive act, and that can only be justified against the pursuer or under the other frameworks we've spoken about. But if what you're doing is an act that immediately is to save someone, even if the secondary impact is damaging to someone else, we could still view that as an act of rescue, and then maybe we have the right to allow that to be a part of the equation. You find this in some of the earlier literature as well. This Teshuva quotes from the Chavis Yar, that the Chavis Yar said that somebody who is a prisoner can run away, even if he knows that there are a group of prisoners and the other ones are going to suffer more because he's run away. So he seems to phrase it in terms of two considerations. One, that he's doing an act of salvation, and two, in that he's motivated to save himself. The fact that he's focused on himself allows him to make that calculation that prioritizes his own life, and those two together seems to be the factor that justify it, and that's a part of his approach. We also find earlier the Pnei Yehoshua seems to give a hint to the general attitude of the Chazon Ish. If you know the story of the Pnei Yehoshua, the commentary on the Talmud, so he writes in his introduction, I remember reading as a child, there's an art scroll book about this, that he wrote this book because he was trapped in a terrible fire that was devastating to a lot of people, and he survived, and he had made a commitment. He said that if I survive this fire, I'm going to go through the Talmud very carefully and write a very thorough commentary. So he writes the introduction that it was a terrible episode, this fire, and that many people died, and there were many who tried to do acts of rescue, and some people died as a consequence of that, of the efforts of the rescuers. Some people died, but he also went on to say he doesn't think that the rescuers have any guilt because of that, because what they were trying to do was to save people, so he doesn't think that they are spiritually liable for what happened. So this attitude that when we're engaged in an act of rescue, so that's going to reflect on what's going on, I think that's very relevant here as well, and that's a part of the larger picture. So clearly, we don't have an easy answer to any of these questions, but this is a part of what goes into the equation.
Two points I don't want to distract you from. One is regarding the Sanhedrin Katani. To what extent is that really reliant on the fact that at all times there was Malchut that was killing serially? They were killing by dance, and the king did whatever they want. So Sanhedrin could be once in 70 years.
I think it's very relevant to that, yeah, because that gets another discussion. If we were talking about the death penalty specifically, we'd get much more into that. I think that is very important, because one could raise the question. The truth is, the question comes up in the Mishnah, and Marcus over there, because the Mishnah quotes that there was a reason, there was response to that, if you're going to take this attitude, first once every, Sanhedrin shouldn't kill 177 years, and then it was 170 years, and then the response, which isn't often quoted when that line is quoted, is that if that's the attitude, so you're for Shoshki Dalman in Israel, there's going to be more murderers among the Jewish people, because everyone's going to know that it's possible to get punished. So it does seem very clear that there were alternative tracks, what we call a Mishpat HaMelech, that the king had the right to do what's necessary to protect society, and the Sanhedrin probably could act in that capacity as well. So we have basically three tracks to deal with questions of the death penalty, either the Sanhedrin, which had a very, very limited mandate how to do it, or the Mishpat HaMelech, which was much more functional, or the Din of Bnei Noach, applying to the whole rest of society, which has its own set of rules. So that's definitely a part of the equation.
The other thing, I'm not sure that, but I'm wondering if the semantics affect the discussion. You're talking about formalism as one option, and someone else will describe the same point of view as the absolute sanctity of life.
Right.
And that might create a different discussion.
I think that may itself be a formalist principle. I think that it may itself, we have to figure out why, it is a different discussion, it's true. The question of why are we ever formalist, to the extent that we do take formalist attitudes, and I think what we see is that we're kind of a mixture of both consequentialist and formalist perspectives. While among philosophers, you can find extreme consequentialists and you can find extreme formalists. So why is anyone ever a formalist? So I think there are probably two ways to explain it. Either, and the first is more likely for secular philosophers, the second has a possibility within a religious perspective. That from a secular perspective, it could be, like we said earlier, that we simply can't have a society where people can make their own decisions about everything, that there's no moral rules, that everyone just gets to decide what they're going to do. That leads to utter chaos and leads to very negative consequences. So we have to have a society that has rules in order for the values to ever actually be manifest. So you can see that on a small scale, you can see that on a large scale. Or you can say, especially I think this is more compelling from a religious perspective, that simply our job here, especially we believe God's running the world anyway, so it's not our job to bring any results. Our job is to honor the values that God created us to honor, that we are here to reflect certain eternal values, and that's our job. So life and its value is one of those ideals that we are meant to esteem, and therefore this affects all of medical ethics. This is one of the, this is supposed to be the non-medical track, but this is really what, this is really what's at the heart of a lot of the medical ethics questions, the idea that, you know, pulling the plug and issues like that, all the questions of abortion and so many other issues, the question of when are we allowed to take a consequentialist attitude and say, okay, society would be better off if we go this way, and when do we say, no, we have to have certain absolutes, this is murder, therefore this is euthanasia, whatever it is, this is something that we can't do. So why do we say we can't, why do we say we have these limits? So there could be two reasons, either because we just, it's going to be a slippery slope once we start making our value decisions, and who knows where we're going to go with this, as we see sometimes with some more extreme utilitarian attitudes. Or maybe no, that maybe our job is not necessarily to save the most lives, our job is to honor the value of life, and that everything has to manifest that. So just, you know, very quickly in terms of the medical ethics question and the ventilator question, so we know that the part of the halachic attitude is to distinguish greatly between what is an act of ritzicha and what is simply holding back life-saving efforts. That reflects that formalist attitude, even though the consequences will be the same. What's the same? What's the difference you sometimes see in medical ethics? The difference between, well, when the tube is being cleaned, you don't have to put it back in, or as opposed to pulling it out in the first place. What's the exact same consequence? But the point is that when it's an action that is an act that could be viewed as causing an end of a life, so then that takes on a whole different perspective. So why? Is it just because we have to have rules, otherwise society falls apart? Or is it because our valuing of life has to be expressed, and therefore we can't take certain steps, even though the consequences will be identical in another way? So I think that very much is a part of the question. And I think we're just almost going to be out of time, so I'll just end with noting that there is a very important idea that we find in Parshas Kisisa after the Egel Hazav. So Moshe Rabbeinu is told to now make a second set of luchos. Moshe Rabbeinu had destroyed the luchos when he saw the Egel Hazav. And the Torah tells us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu instructs Moshe, Absal l'cha shnei luchos avanim kadoshon, you should now make a second set of luchos. So the Medrash has a surprising comment. The Medrash says that Absal l'cha, Moshe, you make the luchos. Why? Because time you're going to make the lulos. And it's a very hard comment to understand because we have a tradition that Moshe did the right thing. The Torah says, the Talmud says, we find this a few places in the Talmud, that the assumption is Moshe did the right thing by breaking the lulos. So how come there's this implicit criticism of Moshe that, oh, now you should see the boss, you have to make the second set. You broke the first set, you have to make the second set. It's a very hard question to understand. It's a little bit similar. We know that Yaakov Avinu was punished, was criticized by Chazal for concealing his daughter Dinah from Esau, that maybe she would have, Esau would have married her, maybe she would have turned him around. Again, it's baffling. I mean, did you ever say to anyone, you have a wonderful daughter, you should try to find the worst possible guy for her to marry, because she'll have an impact on him. I mean, no responsible father would ever say that. So why is Yaakov criticized for hiding Dinah from Esau? So the Baal Musar explained, both cases, and it's even more explicit in the case of Moshe Rabbeinu, that Yaakov did the right thing in hiding Dina, and Moshe did the right thing in breaking the luchos. They were both right. But that does not absolve them from worrying about the consequences. You have a hard decision to make here. Okay, there was something that had to be done, but it had a cost for someone else. There was a loss that happened because of this decision. And we don't have the right to say, okay, if there's a path we have to take, then we don't have to think about anything else. It doesn't have any obligation on our conscience. Now, it goes both ways. It means that we still have to take that step that's necessary, and we're also not excused from thinking about what happens because of that. And that's essentially what we see with Moshe Rabbeinu. He did the right thing, he had to do that. But no, what it cost. You shouldn't say that they don't have to worry at all about the luchos. The fact that the luchos were broken, the fact that Esau lost an opportunity to maybe be turned around, all of that has an impact, and we're not absolved of that. And that's really also explicit in the beginning of Vayishlach, when Yaakov confronts Esav, the Torah tells us that he was very scared and very concerned. So the double language, Chazal explains, he was worried that maybe he would get killed, and he was also concerned that maybe he was going to kill someone else. And so some of the commentators ask, but you're allowed to kill a rodeo, what exactly is the consideration? So we understand what the consideration is, that still comes with a cost, that's still something that we don't want to do, even if it's justified, it's still going to affect who we are. And that's all a part of the equation. So this is very much the mentality of societies that are moral and that are responsible, that we try to figure out how to protect the people and protect the world in a way that is truest to our values. And it's an ongoing process. And it relates to everything that we do and everything that we think about. And that's very much part of our system. So I don't want to take away for the time. Very quickly, what are the highlights we spoke about? That we talked about the challenges of balancing formalist and consequentialist ideas. Sometimes we're consequentialist, like we see with lying to save a life, even less than that, the Talmud allows. But sometimes we're formalist, like we see when it comes to Ritzicha, we say Harav Yavor, and the Talmud has this idea of my chazis, and we thought that it could be interpreted a number of ways, but it seems clear, at least from the Rambam, that it's not about the math, because even when the math is very compelling, like when they say take one of this group, or else we'll kill everyone else, still we don't allow it. Apparently we have this formalist attitude. So when it comes to a rodef, we have permission to kill a rodef, but not anything beyond that, or even the rodef himself if it's not necessary to save a life. So how come in warfare we have this broader permission? So we mentioned a few approaches. We mentioned that we see it evident from Tanakh, as Rosh Hashanah points out, but still we have to explain why. So it could be shifting from a individual perspective to a national perspective, where Yuach Nefesh continues to apply, but on a national scale. We also look at through the prism of the mitzvah of Din and how that justifies and mandates a war on terrorism, especially as that is the most erosive attitude towards Din, and therefore how that has to be compelled, but again, in Ryan Salvatius' understanding in a way that is minimum necessary in order to keep the world safe. And then we talked about the trolley problem, which also highlights our formalist attitude towards murder, where there again, it seems to be clear with the math, 5 versus 1, that the question is diverting the train an act of Ritzicha or not, or even more so if you throw someone in front of the train. So that's the challenge which reflects this formalist attitude. Also the Chazon Ish discussed the question of diverting a missile to a less populated area, and his instinct was to allow it, not conclusively, because he saw that as an act of salvation with negative consequences rather than aggressive action. Talked a little bit about how to define that, if it's the first consequence, if it's the second consequence, the like. It was suggested that we could understand the Chazon Ish's position as dealing with both levels. Consequentially, it makes sense because more lives will be saved than will be lost. And formalistically, it makes sense because it's not an act of murder, it's an act of salvation, and therefore it doesn't betray the value in that sense, even the formalist view as well. talked about how these ideals still have to be balanced by the concern for what is lost, and we noted how we find that in the attitude toward Moshe Rabbeinu and Yaakov, that even when they made understandable decisions of breaking the luchos or concealing Bina, they had a consequence, and that consequence had to be acknowledged, even if the decision was clearly the right decision, and that we find that when Yaakov was concerned about killing others in war,